Well, hi folks, welcome back to Naturally Adventurous. This is Ken and Charlie, and we're chatting yet again about Mexico. This time, we're moving over to the eastern side of Mexico, and we're going to be chatting about the Yucatan Peninsula. I just guided a short trip over there. Charlie, I believe you've been to this part of Mexico before, some 20 years ago?
Yeah, so I was specifically in search of like endangered species of birds. That was my big project, my big expedition that I was doing. And there was one rare bird which was thought might even have been extinct by that point, but I think they actually found it one more time before it did go extinct, and that was a Cozumel thrasher. And I went in search of that on the island of Cozumel, spent a few days there. And then did a little bit of extra stuff along the coast. I think I hit a ruin. Yeah, it was cool. I quite enjoyed it. There's quite a lot of Yucatan endemic birds and stuff. And I must say, it was probably my first experience of the neotropics. It really felt that you were starting to see like toucans, and yeah, it felt quite tropical rather than, you know, further north in Mexico and west.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. It's kind of like neotropics light, you know. You have this semi-deciduous forest, and it has some endemic Yucatan birds, but then you're starting to get some toucans and wood creepers and just some of these real tropical groups. It definitely a good kind of introduction to the neotropics. It's not as overwhelming as just like going to Colombia or Ecuador.
Yeah. But still, it's quite a lot of birds. I remember having quite a big day around there. You know, went to a place, Felipe Carrillo Puerto, which is sort of south along the eastern side of Yucatan. Oh, I wanted to ask you something. Have you heard that story about what Yucatan means? You must have heard this one.
I don't think so.
So Yucatan is Mayan, I think. I guess the Spanish arrived and they asked the locals what the name of the place was. And then the locals said, Yucatan. And the story goes that Yucatan means, I don't understand what you're saying. But I've also heard that that might not be quite right. I've heard another story, which is like listen to them speaking or something like that. You know, they were sort of commenting on how the Spanish were speaking. And then, but there's some other stories as well. But yeah, it's quite a nice little old wives' tale about the name.
I love it. Yeah, I'm just looking it up, and apparently it's not really sure where the name came from, and that's one theory. Yeah. Might have something to do with the Yucatec Maya word for flat. But yeah, just for context, yeah, Mexico is an unusually shaped country. You know, it's got this kind of inverted triangular shape that tapers down to this isthmus. On the far west side, you've got Baja, this massive peninsula. And then on the eastern side, you've got this big chunky Yucatan Peninsula. It's like this, it is remarkably flat. And it's almost all limestone. There's virtually no like flowing surface water in the whole Yucatan. Because in typical limestone environments, water just sinks down into the limestone. But there are these cenotes, these limestone sinkholes all over the place. These like round, deep lakes full of fresh water. And then there are underground cave systems, or like rivers flowing underwater through these cave systems. It's quite a spectacular geography in its way. For a flat place, there's a lot going on.
I don't think I saw any of those sinkholes. I've seen them on documentaries and stuff, and they look pretty spectacular. It's quite a famous thing in the sort of diving community, sort of going down into these things and diving them. And there's all sorts of like cave fish, and you know.
So Yucatan sticks up, and it basically divides the Gulf of Mexico from the Caribbean, and the eastern side. It feels very Caribbean. It's got that kind of brilliant blue, like turquoise water you associate with the Caribbean. And that area is where you have Cancun, which is one of these famous like spring break vacation places. Very heavily touristy. And then along that coastline, you have a lot of tourism. And associated with that is the small island of Cozumel, which is, it's only like 10 miles off of the peninsula. But it has several endemic birds. I mean, strangely enough, the tiny island of Cozumel, which is right next to the mainland, has more endemic birds than the whole of the Baja Peninsula, this massive, you know, whatever it is, 1,000-mile-long peninsula off the west side of Mexico. It's kind of hard to understand biogeography sometimes. It probably comes down to, you know, stability of the climate or age of the formation, I guess, how long that island has been there. But yeah, so the trip that we did, we sort of started on Cozumel, looking for those endemics, and then went to the northern tip of the peninsula, and then went all the way down to the Guatemalan border. The north of the Yucatan is very dry. It's in this, I guess it's kind of a rain shadow. The trade winds don't hit the north very much. So the north is like semi-desert thorn scrub. And then as you go south, it just gets moister and moister, and the forest gets taller. So it's got a pretty good diversity of habitats, again, for a very flat place.
What did you make of Cozumel? I mean, it's a pretty touristy place as well. Still got a bit of habitat there.
You know, Cancun, in my view, is just like this monstrosity that I want to avoid whenever possible. It's it's got like the negatives of a really big city, plus massive numbers of tourists. Things are expensive, and it feels a little bit unsafe. It really doesn't do much for me. Cozumel is quite close to Cancun, so you would expect it to maybe have some of that character. It's actually still a really pleasant place. A much smaller scale tourism development. You don't have like high rises and massive gated resorts and stuff. You know, it's just smaller like hotels and guest houses and apartments. Weird thing about Cozumel is that the east side of the island is virtually untouched, undeveloped. I guess because it gets hammered by hurricanes so frequently. So all the development is on the west side of Cozumel. But yeah, there's a ton of forest left. And it makes it hard to understand why that thrasher, you know, there used to be this thrasher endemic to that island. I don't think it's been seen since maybe the early 2000s. There's a theory that a hurricane basically compromised the habitat in some way.
Yeah, I was there in 2004, I think. Maybe around, it was late. It was maybe like November, something like that, 2004. And there'd been a hurricane. It was always quite rare. And then there'd been a hurricane, and then it hadn't been seen for a while. So it was kind of, wasn't sure whether it was still there or not. And I think subsequently to that, I think it was maybe seen one more time. And then there was another big hurricane came through, and then it wasn't seen after that. So it's most likely gone now. But it is weird. I mean, I was going around it, and there just looked to be a massive habitat. And I didn't see any reason why that that bird would be going extinct. But I mean, it was...
So much forest, and thrashers are generally not super picky about habitat. That's kind of enigmatic, that Cozumel thrasher.
You were mentioning that, some of Yucatan had a sort of Caribbean influence. But, I mean, there was one bird on Cozumel that was, it's like the only place that it's seen, you know, outside
Spindalis,
of the Caribbean.
Western Spindalis.
Spindalis. Yeah, it's a kind of a bizarre bird to have in Mexico.
Cozumel has an amazingly Caribbean feel for an island that is only like 10 miles off the mainland. It's kind of bizarre. You feel like you could almost be in the Lesser Antilles or something in a lot of ways. There's a ton of things from the mainland that don't make it there.
Yeah.
And then there's a bunch of really Caribbean type of birds like white-crowned pigeon and Caribbean alania, Western Spindalis. It really has a fundamentally Caribbean character.
Do you know about the raccoon?
Yeah, a pygmy raccoon, right? It's probably
pygmy
an endemic
raccoon,
subspecies.
Critically endangered, yeah. Well, I think it's considered a different species now. It's got its own endemic species of raccoon.
Just looking it up, and it seems to be amazing.
I saw that thing walking around during the day. I was in some mangroves and it was just kind of walking around in there. And I saw that raccoon like before I'd ever seen the common raccoon. But it's kind of interesting that it has its own like little endemic raccoon there.
Yeah, the Cozumel raccoon, Procyon pygmaeus, also called pygmy raccoon, dwarf raccoon, Cozumel raccoon bear. Well, that's ambitious. Yeah, I didn't realize that had been split, but yeah, critically endangered. So yeah, Cozumel is really quite a different thing. The peninsula itself, it's a weird place. It kind of feels like it's been neglected since the Mayans declined in a lot of ways. I don't know if some of that would have been the ravages of Spanish colonization. There's not that many people in the Yucatan. There's a ton of forest. You know, good quality forest. You know, when I flew out of Yucatan and I went through Mexico City, just flying over central Mexico, I was reminded of how high the population density is in central Mexico. And, you know, that area's been heavily populated for a long time. Yucatan is very different.
And I guess, the Yucatan Peninsula was the sort of the center of the Mayan culture, I guess. And the Mayan language is still spoken, I guess, isn't it, by the locals?
Yeah, as I understand it, the Mayan people were, it was never a single, you know, consolidated empire. It was sort of like city-states, almost like Renaissance Italy. And so there were always a bunch of different Mayan languages. And several of these are still spoken in the region. So yeah, the whole Mayan culture is another fascinating aspect of the Yucatan. And it's kind of haunting because you go to these massive ruins and you see incredibly impressive temples and pyramids. And there's this feeling of like, what happened here? You know, there's still the people are still there and the languages are still spoken. So it's not as if these people are off the face of the earth or something, but something happened. You know, there were inscriptions in the big cities and there were carrying on through time, through the centuries, and then they just stopped at some point, like every major Mayan city, you know, the inscriptions stopped. So something happened. There was some kind of cataclysm that just sort of ended at least that aspect of that civilization. You know, the speculation that it might have been climate related, that it might have been overpopulation, that basically as that empire or those various city-state empires grew in population, that they sort of ran out of water and food. But I think there's a lot of mystery surrounding the decline of those empires.
I see that there's 6 million native speakers of the Mayan group of languages still, so it's still quite a good chunk of people.
Yeah, I think, you know, Guatemala felt quite Mayan in a lot of ways. And, you know, the podcast I did with our friend Danielle, we chatted about that quite a bit. I guess there's some effort these days of like Mayan solidarity, of like people speaking Mayan languages sort of banding together. But, you know, that crosses several different country borders, the sort of Mayan region. So it's not a sort of natural political unit.
I know the Spanish managed to sort of take over the region with a tiny number of soldiers. You know, it was, I think at one point they had some sort of garrison and they were completely surrounded and outnumbered by Mayan warriors. And there's something about like termites. I think when the termites fly, that's the time then you have to go back and start planting your crops and stuff like that. They'd surrounded all these like Spanish soldiers and then they saw these termites flying and they said, oh no, it's time to go and plant our crops. And they all just left. And in that time, in that respite, the Spanish managed to get reinforcements and sort of and take over, you know. But that it's kind of a little quirk of Mayan culture that they were able to do that.
You know, during the Spanish Inquisition, there was an Inquisition in the Yucatan, and it was run by this really sadistic guy. I don't remember his name, but, you know, he was determined to just root out the Mayan culture and languages and religions. Right. And he just gathered together all these like sacred scrolls and just burned them all. And man, what a tragedy. God. Like, we could know so much more about those people and the history if those still existed.
So after Cozumel, you went to the north?
Yeah, up to the north, very briefly, to Rio Lagartos. Did a cool boat trip there through mangroves and saw some flamingos. It's a famous area for American flamingos.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, worked our way south into the more forested zone.
It's quite a cool bird that I've always wanted to see that I didn't get up there, which was the Yucatan wren.
Yucatan wren is quite a... It's in that genus, like the cactus wren, that big, what is it, Campophilus?
Yeah.
In a big, sturdy,
right,
loud, ratcheting vocalizations. It's pretty cool. It that wren is only found along the northern edge of the Yucatan Peninsula in that sort of driest habitat.
So you just had a night there and then you started to head south?
Yeah, that's right. Headed south, went to Chichen Itza, which is one of the most famous Mayan cities. And it's also one of the most like heavily visited. But it's interesting. It's some of these Mayan cities are sort of crumbling, and some of them are sort of overgrown with forest, which is quite cool in its own way. But Chichen Itza has been quite like restored, and you know, it looks more like the city would have when it was inhabited by thousands and thousands of people. So it's quite quite striking. It's a good introduction to the Mayan world in some ways. Spent a night in Valladolid, a really charming city, kind of in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula. I guess it's a big Spanish colonial town, has a massive, you know, plaza and massive cathedral. It's a really, really strikingly old world feeling place.
I'm just looking at a picture of the plaza there. It looks very beautiful, but one thing I notice is that the cathedral has got two towers, two kind of spires, and I know a lot of churches and cathedrals in the New World only built one, and they left it. I think when a church was completed, they had to pay some sort of taxes to Spain, so they would often build one tower and then leave the other one unfinished, so they didn't have to pay these taxes. But I see this one has a finished one. I love Mexican plazas or zócalos or whatever they call them. They're just so full of life, eh? Got very fond memories. You just kind of walk around them and there's like old folks sort of dancing in them and people playing music and all this kind of street food. And they're just so full of life.
Yeah, I totally agree. Actually, one of the things I most enjoyed on this trip, it's a funny thing. In this part of the world, it's very Spanish in that hotels really don't offer breakfast until about 8 or 9 in the morning, which when the sun comes up at 6 and it's a hot climate, that really isn't viable on a birding tour. So I was catering breakfast pretty much every day of the trip I guided. So I was waking up hour before meeting time and, you know, brewing coffee and cutting up fruit and boiling eggs and this kind of thing. But every night I would have to go out into whatever town we were in to buy food, buy supplies for the next day's breakfast, sometimes also lunch. But just had some really cool experiences just walking around, you know, around little plazas and through markets and, you know, buying papayas and mangoes. And it's actually some of my favorite times on this trip. The plazas are so cool. It's just like natural focal point. And sometimes even the tiniest little villages will have their own, you know, mini plaza.
It's funny you say about boiling eggs. Do you ever find that people always ask for boiled eggs but never eat them?
Yes.
I always get this. It's like, oh, what should we have for breakfast? Oh, maybe we can have some boiled eggs. It's like everybody thinks it's a good idea, but nobody actually ends up eating them. And I always end up eating about 10 boiled eggs at the end. I don't want to waste them. It's like, I've kind of lost my enthusiasm for making boiled eggs now. I had one incident on a Taiwan trip, and I had nowhere to boil them. I could buy them in the convenience store, but the only place I could boil them was inside the kettle.
Yep, that's what I was doing.
Yeah, and you sort of put the water in, And then you kind of just very gently drop the eggs in the kettle. And I guess I cracked one. I just dropped it from too big a height. And then this kind of egg coated the inside of the kettle. And just
the coffee tastes strange that morning.
Oh, man. It was just an absolute disaster. And then, of course, nobody ate them anyway. I did 10 eggs myself. Now I'm done with making boiled eggs for people. Eh?
Well, let me tell you, I have got it down to an art at this point. I know how to do it. There's a whole technique to how much water you put in the kettle and how you kind of slide
times you have
the
to
eggs
boil
down
it.
The side.
Right.
There is always that risk because the kettle kind of roils up the eggs. And if you hit it wrong, it can kind of open and explode. And yeah, I've had that a couple times, but I was having pretty good success with the kettle boiled eggs. But it's tricky when you're trying to make coffee and boil eggs in the same morning. You know, you can't afford an explosion.
An explosion. Can I just tell you one more egg story?
Yep.
It's totally unrelated to Mexico or anything. But we had this client in Tropical Birding that's been on a lot of tours, real character. But he taught me a trick. He says, you know what? You don't need to peel the shell off the egg. You can just blow the egg out of the shell. And if you get a boiled egg and you just take a little bit of shell off one end and a little bit off the other, I mean, just like a little tiny little piece, and you sort of blow into it, and then you blow really hard, the whole egg just pops out of the shell. It's a really neat trick. I've shown a few people this trick, and everybody's always impressed by it. And I did it once, but unfortunately, the egg wasn't hard boiled. It was it was somewhat soft, and I guess I had some clients across the table from me, and I blew really hard, and it sort of like sprayed through my fingers. It's like hot, like very very soft boiled egg, like sprayed across the clients on the other side of the table. So yeah, I won't be doing that again either.
You know, there's this expression, egg on your face. I think that's what it came from.
Yeah, the clients definitely had egg on their face after that. But it sounds like you've got your eggs down.
Well, at least until the next explosion. But yeah, I'll tell you, it was a whole thing, like trying to boil eggs and then make coffee. Everybody on my trip, it was a smaller trip. There was three participants and me. Like, we were all, you know, pretty big coffee drinkers. So
yeah,
just trying to provide enough coffee to keep people going. We had some great field breakfast, though. Like, I was buying nice fresh avocados and mangoes. So, you know, you're out in some forest somewhere, just eating like tostadas with fresh avocado on top. Oof, good stuff.
Was it a car shootery?
It was a car shootery.
You know, you've got a bit to answer for here. I had a listener that came on one of my tours, and they'd heard this thing about Kenny's car shootery. And I'm like, Charlie, can we have a car shootery? And I was like, yeah, sure. And he just wouldn't shut up about it the whole trip. It's just always, okay, are we going to have a car shootery today? And I was like, oh, we'll see. And then, you know, the place didn't really lend itself to a car shootery. You know, there was no kind of cold meats and cheeses and stuff. It was, I don't know, it might have been in Asia somewhere. But yeah, Ken's car shootery.
Well, I have to give credit. I did not come up with that term. It was some folks that I, some friends that I guided in South Africa. Brilliant. They came up with that term.
It's a great name.
The next trips I'm guiding are in Spain. So I've already got some epic car shooteries planned.
Oh. So yeah, early mornings catering for clients. Yeah, that's a lot of work, eh?
You know, Thailand is a pretty full-on trip. You've just been guiding in Thailand, I believe. I would put this Yucatan trip up there as one of the most full-on trips as far as what you have to do as a guide. It's also quite a fast-paced trip. You know, a lot of one-night stays in places. And then, yeah, the catering situation, you know, it's quite fun. I actually like doing this, but it is exhausting for sure. I mean, by the time, I guided Baja straight to Yucatan, straight into guiding that trip. and then straight to West Mexico when I did the three intense days that we chatted about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
When I got home, my tank was pretty empty. I was pretty exhausted.
Yeesh. So any other highlights, like further south from there?
Yeah, well, low lights.
All low lights.
It was, I don't know if you've heard about this whole Train Maya project, but it's this massive project to basically build a train network that goes all around the Mexican Yucatan. It goes all the way from Merida across to Cancun and then down south and then all the way over to Palenque in Chiapas. And theoretically, it's supposed to promote massive growth of tourism and sort of decentralized tourism, get tourists out of Cancun into other parts of the peninsula. I don't know what to think of it, but I can tell you there are massive construction zones all throughout sort of southern Quintana Roo into Campeche, and it was construction on a scale I've never really seen before. I mean, just thousands and thousands of trucks. It feels like every truck in Mexico was hired for this job. I mean, they are serious about building this train. I mean, they're just working in hundreds of places simultaneously on building this train. Part of it's already done. It's actually already operating, maybe Valladolid to Cancun or something like that. But I've never seen such as a massive infrastructure project for tourism before. And it strikes me as either the real reasons for doing this are not what they are publicly proclaimed to be, or it's a very risky thing to, you know, this is like a $1 billion project. And I just can't imagine sort of.
It seems more like back. A sort of Chinese style thing to do than a Mexican style thing to do.
Exactly. But I have to say, like, it was pretty awful to see in a lot of ways, like forests torn up and just the traffic. But man, they were serious about this thing. I mean, just the coordination organization to do this is actually pretty impressive. It didn't seem to be foreign companies. It seemed all Mexican. Yeah, something very weird about the whole Train Maya project. I've heard a theory that the goal is actually to connect the Caribbean and or Gulf of Mexico with the Pacific via that train as a potential alternative to the Panama Canal, if the Panama Canal becomes unviable or less viable. I don't know. I mean, that's a rumor.
They were talking at one point in Ecuador about having these navigable rivers and these kind of locks going over the Andes and stuff. And I think this was this might have been kind of maybe Chinese money or there's some major funding. It does seem like there might be some sort of alternative plan. Because, I mean, who are the foreign tourists coming into Yucatan? They're Americans, I guess. And somehow thinking if you build a train, all these Americans are suddenly going to flock out of Cancun and go to other places. It just doesn't seem very realistic, really.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard for me to imagine. And just the sheer scale of this thing, I mean, the size of the train stations, massive. They built a train all the way down to Calakmul, which it's one of these ancient Mayan cities. It was one of the big ones. They were like the big rivals of Tikal in Guatemala.
Yeah.
And this place was just completely abandoned. I think even the local Mayan people didn't know about it. It was just so remote back in the forest. And there was some American guy doing some kind of surveying back in the 20s, I believe, 20s or 30s. And he flew a small plane over the southern Yucatan and saw these massive temples down in the jungle, told people, and then a big expedition was mounted and, real Indiana Jones type of stuff. Mm. So this place, well into the 20th century, was the absolute middle of nowhere, the wilderness. And even up until like 2 years ago, it was still the middle of nowhere. But they decided to build a spur line of this Train Maya all the way down to this ruins, deep, deep in the Mayan Biosphere Reserve. So that whole road was just torn up and covered in trucks, even at like 7 in the morning. They're just dozens of trucks and dust, and you know, it's pretty disheartening. And it's just hard to imagine like mass scale tourism at a place like that in the middle of nowhere. No hotels, no restaurants. Don't know. There's something very odd about the whole project.
Can you see anything positive coming out of it? You know, maybe it'll recover a little bit. And
yeah, I think it's at its worst right now, you know, because there's active construction in so many places. And I think when the construction's done, the dust will literally settle. A lot of places will be better again. Now, will all of this just be the prelude to a lot of people like moving in and logging and then starting slash and burn agriculture? You know, that is so often the pattern around the world. So that's definitely a concern. I kept sort of devil's advocating, you know, could this actually work out? And like, is this a really bold thing that is really going to pay off in the long term? And, is this going to become like the next really popular tourist destination? And is it really going to succeed wonderfully? I really don't think so. But I kept, you know, asking myself whether there was something more to this than I was seeing. Mass scale tourism just seems to me questionable in a lot of ways. And I'm not sure that it ultimately is that good for a country. So even if the thing does succeed fabulously, it's going to so change the character of the Yucatan that, you know, I think from that perspective, it may be questionable whether it's really a good thing.
I'm just reading something here that, they started the project, what, in like 2018, and then a new president held a referendum about the Mayan Train project, and 92.3% voted in favor. So it seems the locals like the idea of it. I mean, I guess it will bring kind of wealth and opportunity to people that live there already, but maybe it's something that makes more sense to Mexicans. I don't know.
I always wonder, you know, who were those people there and how are they chosen? This is pretty fascinating. So on the day we were driving down to the Xpujil, which is the town nearest to Calakmul. It's a long, long day's drive. You know, you're out early, you're birding all morning, and then you're driving 4 hours or so. And we were about 15 minutes from our hotel. You know, everybody's tired, it's super hot. We're driving along, and then all of a sudden, trucks are stopped in the road in front of us. Now, this is weird. Well, we started passing trucks because we thought, well, you know, maybe this is a truck-only thing. Maybe they're queued up to go into some construction site here with the train Maya or something. Just keep passing trucks, passing trucks, passing trucks. Miles of trucks. And then there's a few other people doing the same thing that I'm doing. They're driving past all these trucks. And I'm sort of following them, and we're weaving around trucks. And then I realize nobody's coming from the other direction. Oh, man, that's a bad sign. Well, finally, we get up to the head of this line. And it's probably like 10 kilometers of stopped traffic, mostly trucks that we drove by. You know, there's a crazy volume of trucks on this road right now because of this train project. We get up to the front of the line and we stop. We're not going any further. You know, the traffic is just jammed in. Okay, get out and start talking to people, trying to understand what's going on. And basically people are telling me, oh, the government has stopped the road, this and that. We need to get approval. And finally, the story comes that some local folks are unhappy with some aspect of the train Maya, and they are protesting. Classic kind of Mexican thing or Latin American thing, right? And they have blocked this road. And sure enough, I mean, I walk like 100 yards past where I'm parked, and there they are. There's like 4 pickup trucks blocking the road, and they're holding up signs. And they have just stopped all the traffic for hours. And, you know, there's thousands of vehicles backed up in both directions. And then there's this intense negotiation going on. There's these heavily militarized Mexican police there, you know, holding machine guns, as they always do, wearing like head to toe, this like white camo stuff they always wear. I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
And they're having a negotiation with this caballero, this like older gentleman wearing a cowboy hat, and his like family or supporters who are protesting. And I guess the deal was they were saying, you know, you need to, there was something promised to them when the Tren Maya was planned that hadn't been delivered, you know, some compensation for land and their ranch or something.
Right.
And that hadn't been delivered. And they were, this was, they felt like this was their only recourse. And essentially the police or military people on the ground there were waiting for some kind of approval from Mexico City to like, yes, we're going to pay this guy for his land or something. And then he was going to move and all the traffic could go. So wow. It was fascinating. And we spent about 2 hours stuck there. And it was starting to be, you know, I was starting to think, okay, well, do I need to book another hotel and go back out of this massive scrum? And are we not going to make it to our hotel? And but thing opened up eventually. Traffic started to move. Protesters moved off the road. I guess the government had promised to do whatever they wanted. And we eventually made it to our hotel right around sunset. After sitting there for 2 hours, it's quite the experience. I was thinking, I don't think that would ever be tolerated in the States. You know, imagine you try to block some interstate highway with a few pickup trucks and like hold up protest signs. Yeah. I mean, I just think the National Guard or whoever would just be out there in an hour and just push your vehicles off the road, you know? Yeah. So, you know, in a weird way, it was dealt with quite gently.
Right. So you mentioned that Baja California felt really safe and the West Coast, this might be a little bit edgy. What was the general feeling of sort of safety and security in Yucatan?
Quite safe, except for Cancun.
Which is where everybody is.
It's so weird. It's so weird. It's I mean, so weird. I was just reading an article about some American students who were held up on the beach in Cancun by guys in military uniforms with rifles, and they basically extorted money out of these students. Yeah, I mean, to me, you'll be safe anywhere in the Yucatan except Cancun, and that's where everyone goes. Very strange.
It's amazing, eh? And tourism is pretty booming there at the moment. I mean, how is it compared to how it was years ago?
Tourism is booming to an extent that I actually was amazed by. I mean, there are
really
vast numbers of people coming through Cancun. I flew in from Baja. I arrived at 2 a.m. and there was a big queue at the rental car counter. I mean, I couldn't believe it. That just the number of people, and it's not only Americans. I mean, people from all over the world are going to Cancun. It really seems to have built up some kind of brand name that's And it's not only Cancun now, it's like that whole east side of the peninsula is getting quite developed, and resorts all over the place and all kinds of attractions and golf courses. And yeah, it's, despite all the gloom and doom you hear about Mexico, like people are going to Mexico.
Is it mainly sort of Baja California and Yucatan? People used to go to Oaxaca quite a bit and a few other places, but I guess it's mainly concentrated in these kind of like tourist areas.
I think that's probably true. I haven't been to Oaxaca for a long time, but my guess is that, yeah, it really is. Like those are the two nodes of tourism now, is really like Southern Baja and the Cancun area. Although, as I mentioned when we chatted about West Mexico, Puerto Vallarta was humming with tourists as well. So, don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe there's just a lot more tourists in Mexico than I realized, or is portrayed by the media. I have been told that Acapulco used to be, you know, it used to be like Cancun, but apparently it's like virtually abandoned just because of
really
at least the perception of insecurity in Guerrero. So one of the things I'm working on right now is sort of trying to reboot this tour based on all the construction and what's happening down there. So I actually think, chatting with our mutual friend Phil Schoen, who also has guided this trip sometimes, like we probably have a way of making this trip a lot better for the future. So coming soon to the Tropical Birding website is Yucatan Rebooted. It is, despite the construction, it is a really cool part of the world and really do recommend it, and it's a good intro to the Neotropics. But we'll close out this episode. We haven't really talked much about the birds and other wildlife on this trip, but one of our favorite birds was a Mayan ant thrush. This is a real tropical type of bird, right? Ant thrushes are real typical neotropical birds, and basically heard this on the road down to Kalakmul early one morning, and it was one of these full-on, like, bushwhacking through the jungle, getting closer and closer, and then freezing and trying to get everybody to stay still, and then the bird gets a little bit closer, and, you know, it was one of these really great sightings, and you know, hard work as a guide, but very satisfying. Eventually had this thing sitting, perched up, not moving, but only visible through this tiny little window. So it was kind of like maneuvering people one by one to, you know, look through this little window through the vegetation. Everybody eventually got great views of this Mayan ant thrush. So yeah, we'll play out with a Mayan ant thrush recording. Thanks for listening, folks. Big thanks to the people who sponsor us, our patrons. And yeah, I think we're done with Mexico for a little while. We'll catch you next week with some kind of new topic.